morning. I apologize that I don't show up. Everybody comes, but okay. All the other times are almost empty, but I'm here most of the time. The problem was that for some reason there was no transportation. No cabs, no buses, no light rails. So I waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. Eventually I got a cab. I called the cab and it took almost a half an hour for it to show up. Okay, but I do apologize. Anyway, as always, this year for the entire year is sponsored by Rabbi Raphael and Sharon Aumann in memory of their parents, Edith and Reiner Aumann, Yonah ben Sadok and Esther Bas Raphael, and their son, Harav Shmuel Eliyahu Aumann. And may all of the learning be le'ilei nishmatam, and we greatly appreciate the very, very generous Hachzakas Torah. You know, Shlomo HaMelech tells us, Dovor bi'ito matov, how good it is to say something that fits the particular time of year. And it happens to be that in this Parshas HaShavua, we have exactly a mitzvah that we're doing this time of year. This Parsha, Parshas Emor, is the source of the mitzvah of counting of the Omer, the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. We're going to read about it this Shabbos. So halachically, I want to talk a little bit about the great mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. The Torah tells us in Parshas Emor, this Parsha, Usvartem lachem mimacharas HaShabbos, and you will start counting from the day after Shabbos, that's what it says, miyom haviyachem es omer hatnufa, from the day that you begin, you bring the omer, which is a measure of barley, on the second day of Pesach, hatnufa, that is waved. Now, the Mishnah in Menachos records a machlokas that apparently existed for hundreds of years between the Tzdukim, those are the Sadducees. That was a group during the Second Temple that did not believe in the authority of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and they read the Torah fairly literally, versus the Prushim, the Pharisees, who in the Christian Bible get a bad knock, but they are our sages, they are our Chachamim. And that is, what is the meaning of Shabbos in that Pasuk? The Tzdukim, consistent with their literal reading of the Torah, define the word Shabbos as Saturday. And therefore, Sfirat HaOmer always commences on the Sunday after Pesach, meaning after the first day of Pesach, meaning you begin Mimacharas HaShabbos. The Prushim have many, many proofs and many, many arguments that Shabbos in this Pasuk does not mean Saturday. Shabbos in this Pasuk means the Yom Tov of Pesach, because that's also called the Shabbos, you refrain from Malacha, and therefore Mimacharas HaShabbos is the day after the Yom Tov of Pesach, in other words, the second day of Pesach. So we're going to go with that. We will explain a little later on, in other shiurim, as we're going to go through until Shavuos, why the Torah uses the word Shabbos if it actually means Pesach. So according to our Mishnah, oh, by the way, just a little digression for a moment, it's important just historically that you differentiate the group that is called Tzedukim from a later group that is called Karaim. Many people think the Karaites are just another name for the Sadducees. In fact, they are two different groups that were separated by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. The Tzedukim was a fairly large group that existed during the Second Temple. And interestingly enough, although their ideology was a rejection of the oral law and a literal interpretation of the Torah, but it could very well be that the Tzedukim were not motivated by religious principle, but rather it was an issue of political and social control. For example, we have a lot of proofs that the Tzedukim were largely the wealthy aristocratic class that lived in Eretz Yisrael, and philosophically they were aligned with Hellenism. So their rejection of the oral law was kind of a consequence of a Hellenistic, materialistic philosophy. The Tzedukim, and the reason it's called Tzedukim is because the founder of the movement was a person who had been a rabbi, Tzedok. Tzedok and Baisus, that's why there was a parallel movement, Tzedukim uBaisusim. It's hard to know exactly if there's any difference between them, or these were just different leaders of different segments. The Tzedukim as a movement became extinct by the Churban Beis HaMikdash. They simply didn't survive. There were no I mean, there could have been individuals, but as a movement, there were no tzedukim after the Churban Bayis. And the Perushim, actually that name wasn't used either, but the Pharisees morphed into Chazal, the Tanoim, the Amorayim, etc., which took the legacy of the Perushim. The term Perushim and Tzedukim is only used during the Second Temple period, meaning Chazal, after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, do not even go by the name Perushim at that particular point. Now, if you go forward to the year 1000, which is many, many years after the Churban Bayis Sheni, let's assume the year 70, 68 to 70. So now we're talking about the year 1000. This is after the finishing of the Gemara, both the Babylonian and the Yerushalmi, and this is during the period of the Gaonim. So the main Jewish community were primarily in Bavel. And there was a small yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And there were two positions in Bavel, actually maybe three positions in Bavel, that were of paramount importance. One was the political position that already existed in Talmudic times, but it continued, which was called Reish Galusa, the head of the exile. That was kind of the political position of leadership, which had direct contact with the caliphs or whatever, whoever was ruling over that particular area. Sometimes the Reish Galusas were learned, oftentimes they were not. Sometimes they worked with the Talmidei Chachamim, other times they did not. And this already we see in Talmudic times, but this continued in the period of the Gaonim. In addition, although there were a number of yeshivot in Bavel, there were two yeshivos that had preeminent authority in the interpretation of Jewish law. They were the yeshivos of Sura and the yeshivas of Pumpadisa. These are referred to by the Rishonim as Haminag Shebishtei Yeshivot. And these are Sura and Pumpadisa, and these were really the halachic centers for the entire Jewish world. The entire Jewish world would turn to the Gaonim in Bavel for various tshuvos and the like. And in fact, the term Gaon was the term that was used. Now today we use Gaon like for every rabbi is a Gaon. As you go to a chasna in Eretz Yisrael, everybody is Harav HaGaon. But Gaon was not used, it was only used very specifically for the heads of those two yeshivos, the head of Sura and the head of Pumpadisa. Nobody else was honored with the title Gaon, Excellency, Gaon Yaakov, the excellence, the majesty of Yaakov. Sura was technically the more authoritative of the two, but both of them were very authoritative, and depending on the time, sometimes the Gaon of Pumpadisa was greater than the Gaon of Sura, sometimes not, so that kind of changed the balance.
But in
Nardah? Huh? Yeah, Nardah was long gone. Nardah was in the time of the Amoraim, but in the time of the Gaonim, the two yeshivas were Sura and Pumpadisa. There was no Nardah at that particular point. Now, we're talking about the 700s, 800s, 900s, in fact, by the year 1000 already, which was the death of Rav Hai Gaon, who is the last of the Gaonim and the greatest of the Gaonim. The yeshivas were destroyed by Muslims, by Islamic persecution, and that is kind of the end of the period of the Gaonim, and then we have a new tekufa of Rishonim, where the Torah moved from Babel to Europe in various ways. Italy, and then Germany, and then Poland, and Russia, etc. That's a different tekufa. Now, in one of the instances, during the time of Rav Sadia Gaon, who was also one of the greatest of the Gaonim, the position of Reish Galusa was up for grabs. And there was a fellow, Anan ben David, who wanted the position of Reish Galusa. He didn't get it. So as a result, he just decided to start his own religious movement, which denied the authority of the Jewish community generally, and this was called Karaim. Karaim is Mikra, Psukim. They look at the literal meaning of the Tanakh. So Karaim, in some ways, was a continuation of the ideology of the Tzedukim, but there's not a direct causal link. The Tzedukim had been extinct hundreds and hundreds of years before the Karaim arose, and quite literally, we know, Anan ben David invented the Karaite movement. Karaim actually grew fairly much. There were large, large communities of Karaim, particularly in Mitzrayim, and even in Eretz Yisrael, that there were large Karaite movements. And what's interesting is, because the Karaim did not accept the Gemara did not accept the Torah Shebal Peh, they devoted all of their scholarly energies primarily to explication of biblical texts. So as a result, they became quite proficient in grammar, in diktuk, and the like. And what's interesting is certain biblical commentaries, some of our Mefarshim, the Ibn Ezra and the Abarbanel, will sometimes quote Karaite commentaries to understand the meaning of the word. Sometimes they'll argue with them, but other times they will accept them as very valid. In fact, one of the, still to this day, one of the most impressive anti-Christian missionary books, right? The Christian missionaries will take biblical verses, psukim from Tanakh, and try to apply them to Yashka and the like. And we, and since unfortunately many B'nai Torah and even many rabbis are not necessarily proficient in Nach, we don't always know how to respond. So there is a literature within Judaism which offers the correct interpretation of these verses to refute missionary claims. The Abarbanel does it a lot. The Radak does it a lot, although some of that was censored from the Radak's commentary. But the Radak in Tehillim will often address missionary concerns, how Judaism interprets things, and the like. So one of the best counter-missionary books we have was written by a Karaite, I think in the 1600s. It's called Chizuk Emuna, The Strengthening of Faith. And there is something actually pretty strong about a Karaite reputation of Christianity, because let me explain why. Let's say a Christian makes certain claims. So I say to the Christian, well, you can't say that because the Gemara says X, Y, and Z, or the Medrash says X, Y, and Z. Well, the Christian's response is, I don't accept the Gemara, I don't accept the Medrash. So how can you refute me by bringing in sources that you regard as authoritative, but I don't regard as authoritative? What gives the Karaite reputation a bigger punch is that they didn't make their arguments based on Talmud or Medrash, because they didn't believe in it either. They based it on textual analysis of the biblical text. Now that, even Christians are kind of stuck with. If you show that a given interpretation contradicts what the Bible says, then you got a very powerful argument. So Chizuk Emuna, you can still get the book. I think it may even be online at Hebrew Books. And it's been translated in English as well. It's actually a very classic Karaite text that refutes the claims of Christianity. Be it as it may, there is a discussion today. There are some Karaites still around. And do we regard them as halachically Jewish, or perhaps with intermarriage they become Goyim? So Rav Avadya Yosef famously paskened that he was very familiar with the large Karaite community of Mitzrayim, and although they were Kofrim, they denied Torah Shebal Peh, but he said they were ethnically Jewish because they did not intermarry with non-Jews. There's also a famous passage in the Rambam where the Rambam says that those, this is where the idea of Tinok Shenishba is introduced for the first time. I mean, it's not the first time the word is used, but the first time was used for deviant movements. Like you often hear today, oh, Reform Jews, Conservative Jews, we cannot label them negatively because they are like babies that were raised in captivity. So the first person who used that argument regarding deviant movements was none other than the Rambam, who was describing the children of the first Karaites. And he says, the children of the first Karaites, we cannot condemn as Rishayim, because they were raised with that false ideology, and therefore there is a mitzvah to be makarev them, there's a mitzvah to love them, to bring them close to God. Again, we absolutely reject the ideology is considered to be false, but the Rambam says we do not stigmatize the Karaim, at least in Mitzrayim, because by his time already, which was already a few generations after Anan ben David, they were already had the halachic status of Tinok Shenishba. Anan ben David did not have that status, obviously, because he was exposed, he grew up with the traditions of Judaism and rejected them. It's amazing, he rejected them because he didn't get a job he wanted. I mean, it's pretty interesting that you... Of course, they say the same thing about Muhammad in some ways. You know, Muhammad was a camel driver, and he worked for a lot of Jews. A lot of his bosses were Jews. And he had a very vivid imagination, And when they would tell at night, the Jewish owners would tell stories from the Medrash and everything else. So this inflamed Muhammad's imagination. And it is recorded in some sources, I can't say it's 100% true, that he actually wanted to convert to Judaism because he liked the stories. But he was not accepted, so he figured he'll do his own version. So religions can get founded for all sorts of funny reasons. Okay, so that's just a digression to differentiate the Tzukim from the Karaim. But going back to the Omer, it was the Tzukim's interpretation of Shabbos that Shabbos was Sunday. The Prushim interpretation of Shabbos is first day of Pesach, which is also like a Shabbos because you don't do work on it. And therefore, Mimacharat HaShabbat, according to us, is the second day of Pesach. According to them, it is the Sunday, the first Sunday after Pesach. Now, you find in the Mishnah, when I say after Pesach, I mean after the first day. I don't mean after the last day. Now, you find in the Gemara and in the Mishnah an extraordinary idea that for hundreds and hundreds of years, this controversy was going on, and the sages went to great lengths to dispel any credibility given to this. Like, why was this taking root more than other heresies? There are many, many heresies, but this one seems to be a popular one. So one of the explanations that's given is because the calendar of the Tzukim, which, by the way, the Karaites follow that calendar to this day. They actually do follow the calendar. They've taken that over. You can even get a website. There's Karaite websites and everything else, is because it gave everybody a two-day holiday on Shavuos. Think about Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, all you get is a one-day Yom Tov. Okay? All right, so for Pesach and Sukkot, you still get plenty of relatively free time because you got a Chol HaMoed. Shavuos is one day and that's it. But think about this. If you follow the Tzuki calendar, that Svirat HaOmer always starts on a Sunday. So if day one of Svira is Sunday, then day 49 is Shabbos, the last day of the Omer, and Shavuos is day 50, right? So it turns out you always get a two-day holiday. You get Shabbos and Shavuos together. Now, maybe from our secular perspective, we almost don't like that, right? That's kind of reason. Oh, gee, you know, I don't want to have 2 days together. And then in Chutzlar, it's 3 days, the dreaded 3-day Yom Tov, which we can still get on Rosh Hashanah, 2 days, right, Thursday, right? So we don't like it. But in the ancient world, and maybe when Jews were more righteous, they actually enjoyed the notion of 2 days together, particularly if these were vacation days, so to speak. So the popularity of the Tzukim was that they gave you a two-day holiday on Shavuos. Like the Prushim, you often only had 1 day. Now listen, like the Prushim, you can also have 2 days because our calendar can also be that Pesach is Shabbos and then the Omer is Sunday, right? We can have the same thing. But that's B'mikra. That only happens every few years. They had it every single year, that particular way. And in fact, the Gemara records that one of the Tzukim made an argument to the Prushim. It's not an argument, but he says, listen, Moshe Rabbeinu loved the Jewish people, so he wanted them to have a two-day holiday. And that's why he made the counting of the Omer on Sunday. As if Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who made it up. I mean, even that language is not appropriate. If you're going to say somebody loved us and gave us the mitzvah, you would say Hashem loved us. You wouldn't say Moshe Rabbeinu loved us and made the mitzvah this way. Okay. Now, the Torah says you start counting from the day after Pesach, right? Well, that's how we'll learn, second day of Pesach, from the day that you bring the Omer offering. Now, what is the Omer offering, right? The Omer. So Omer itself is simply a measure, like we could talk about a bushel, right? And Omer happens to be a tenth of an ephah, which is the volume of around 43 eggs, a little bit more than 43 eggs. And Omer has importance in a number of things. It is the amount of man that fell every day for morning and night, Omer legulgolet. And it is also the volume of dough, that if you're making dough, that is chayav to separate the challah. So Omer pops up in a number of places, the shear of man, the shear of challah, and it is a volume of barley that was brought, barley, that was brought on the second day of Pesach. Part of it was sacrificed on the altar, part of it, and the rest was eaten by the Kohanim. Of course, it was baked as matzah. It was Pesach. Of course, all menachas are usually baked as matzah, but Pesach for sure. All right? And this is the Omer. This is called the Korban HaOmer. Now, the Korban HaOmer had, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, an extremely important halachic function. There was an Isser in the Torah to eat Chadash, the grain of the new year. And you could not eat the grain of the new year, until the Korban of the Omer was brought, that matired Chadash. Now, in truth, the Isser of Chadash still applies even today, but the Gemara has a drasha that when there's a Beis HaMikdash, you cannot eat the Chadash until the Korban Omer is brought. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, you cannot eat Chadash until the day comes, meaning to say, the day is the 16th of Nisan. So, Bizman HaMikdash, I could not eat the Omer, I could not eat the Chadash till the Omer was brought. Today, I cannot eat the new grain of the new year until the morning of the 16th of Nisan. Meaning, anything I eat before that point has to be from last year's grain. Again, I'm glossing over right now.
Is Bali not chametz?
Say again?
Bali, chametz?
The Omer was not chametz. It was barley that was baked as matzah. It was grain, but it was not washed. It was not it was not chametz. Okay. Yeah. Now, right now I'm glossing over what is new grain, what is old grain. That's not so simple. But the basic idea is that Bizman HaZeh, you could not eat the new grain until the morning of the 16th of Nisan. But the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a takana that you have to wait until the morning of the 17th of Nisan. And the reason is the following. If we were to allow you to eat Chadash on the 16th of Nisan in the morning, what happens if next year the Beis HaMikdash gets rebuilt? And you're going to remember, oh, last year we ate the Chadash at the crack of dawn, so now we can also eat Chadash at the crack of dawn. But you can't, because once you have a Beis HaMikdash, you have to wait until the Omer. So to avoid any problems, he said, listen, don't eat at all on the 16th, eat the morning of the 17th, and when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, then you'll eat after you bring the Omer on the 16th. Right? So therefore, Lamaisa, Chadash is Usher until the morning of the 17th of Nisan. But Bizman HaMikdash, it was Usher until you brought the Korban Omer itself. The Omer, so the way this is expressed is, the Omer matirs the Chadash. The Omer is a matir. Now, the truth of the matter is, in Eretz Yisrael, there is no question that the laws of Chadash apply, and therefore you can't eat Chadash. You have to eat Yashan until the Omer, until the day of the Omer, which is, in this case, the 17th. Whether there's an Isser of Chadash and Chutz La'aretz is already a machlokas in the Gemara, and it's a huge, huge machlokas among the poskim, how we paskin. The Ramah has certain leniencies regarding Chadash and Chutz La'aretz, and most of the mainstream Hashgachot in the United States they're not makbid, they're not particular on Chadash or Yashan, because they rely on the Ramah, but more Haredi, more Hasidish, more Yeshivish Hashgachot are machmer on it. So that's why you'll find that there are directories out of Lakewood telling you which products are Chadash, which products are Yashan. It's based on product codes. You have to read the computer codes on packages and the like, because I believe the OU will not necessarily supervise whether something is Chadash or Yashan. But again, let me emphasize, there's an obvious point, that the whole question here is only Legabe Chutz La'aretz grain. Legabe Eretz Yisrael grain, there is absolutely no question that the laws of Chadash must be observed even today, but you don't have to worry about it. I mean, whatever Hashgacha you rely upon, whatever you consider reliable, which I won't get into that either, they will be certifying that what you will be getting will be yashan, will not be chadash. Anyway, this time of year, there's no problem at all, because since we're so close to the day of the Omer, everything that's out there had already been growing before the Omer date, and therefore the Omer date matured it. It's only the stuff that gets planted after the Omer date that's going to be a problem until next Omer date. And the stuff that was planted after the Omer date is not going to get to market at the earliest before the end of the summer or even around Sukkot time. So therefore, generally speaking, this is a generalization, between Pesach and Sukkot, there is no Yashan problem whatsoever or Chadash problem whatsoever. The problem will be from Sukkot to Pesach. Okay, because the stuff that was planted before Pesach is covered by the Omer. The stuff that's planted after Pesach is not going to be covered till next Omer. So if that hits the market, that's going to be a Chadash problem. Okay. So note again that the Torah says two things. When do you start counting the Omer? In other words, there are two identifiers in the Pasuk. One is Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos, which we define as second day of Pesach. The second is from the day that you bring the Korban of the Omer. That is also the second day of Pesach. Why do we have two identifications? So most Rishonim, specifically Tosos and Menachos, actually says a very important idea, that the mitzvah to count the Omer today is only rabbinic. It is not min haTorah, because the Torah commandment is connected to the bringing of the Omer. And when there's no Omer that you're bringing, because there's no Beis HaMikdash, there is no obligation to count the Omer. And if we count the Omer when there's no Beis HaMikdash, it is only rabbinic as what is called Zecher LeMikdash. So according to Tosfos and most Rishonim, the counting of the Omer Bizman Hazeh is Midrabanan, because the Oraisa, it is connected to the Korban of the Omer. That may actually explain why many people, and it's in every Siddur, after you count the Omer, so there's one line, some people say all sorts of Tehillim afterwards, but there's one line that everybody says, Harachaman, may the merciful one return us to the service of the temple, and some add, b'meira v'yameinu, amen. Why do you put that in? Because you're kind of saying, now I'm only doing this mitzvah as a commemoration of the mikdash, but I pray that we should have the Beis HaMikdash, so I will fulfill the mitzvah to Oraisa. That is the Shita of Taisus and Menachos. The Shita of the Rambam, which is a Das Yochid, but it is the Rambam, says that Sviras HaOmer does not depend on the Korban of the Omer. The Torah just gave that as an identifying date, but even when there's no Korban HaOmer, the mitzvah of Svira is a Torah requirement. So we have a big, big machlokas. Is Sviras HaOmer Bizman Hazeh a Da'oraisa or a Drabana? Obviously, drabbanans are obligatory too, right? People sometimes have this expression, it's only midrabbanan. No, what do you mean it's only midrabbanan? First of all, the Rambam himself says that there's a mitzvah saseh and a lo saseh in the Torah to obey rabbinic decrees. In other words, if I'm over on a drabbanan, I am transgressing a positive and a negative commandment, because it says in Parsha Shoftim, al pi haTorah asher yerucha, according to the Torah that they teach you, and lo sasur, do not depart from what they say, yamin usmol, to the right or to the left. It's very tempting, although I don't think that's the pshat, to use right or left the way we use it today. You know, right is to be extra, extra strict. Right? Don't go to the right, don't go to the left, don't be overly righteous, don't be negligent of the Torah. But again, that's probably not what it means in that context. So the fact that something is drabbanan does not take away from its chashivos. But there is a very big nafkamina between whether something is d'oraisa or drabbanan, and let me give you one outstanding example. Not so much in Eretz Yisrael, because the twilight period is very short here, but in Chutz La'aretz, it's very common that people daven Ma'ariv sometimes, certainly before Tzeitzer Kochavim, before the stars are out, and sometimes even before Shkia. But a common situation in the United States would be that we daven Mincha before sunset. Let's say we daven Mincha, we start Mincha 10 or 15 minutes before Shkia, and then when we're finished, we wait until Shkia, and then we daven Maariv. That's a common pattern in the United States. We don't wait, like Shabbos, for the stars to come out. Now, without getting into all the complications, the period between sunset and the stars coming out is a period that Chazal, it's called twilight, so Chazal used the term Bein Hashmashot. And twilight, what is the status of Bein Hashmashot? It is, halachically, a doubtful period. It may already be night, it may still be day. That's why, generally speaking, Bein Hashmashos, you have to be machmir on both sides of it. This would explain, for example, why Shabbos begins no later than sunset, but it cannot end until you have three stars in the sky. Why? Because between Shkia and the three stars is a suffix. We don't know what it is. So I got to start Shabbos at sunset because maybe Bein Hashmashot is Lila. But I can't end Shabbos at sunset because maybe Bein Hashmashot is still day, which is why Shabbos Yom Kippur, by definition, will be longer than 24 hours. It goes from sunset to Tzeit HaKochavim, whatever your share is of Tzeit HaKochavim. Again, everything here is a huge discussion. Right? Shabbos Yom Kippur. So, Bein Hashmashos is a suffix. Now, before we get to Sphere, let's talk about how that works for Maariv. I daven Maariv after Shkia. But how can I be Yotzei Maariv? Maybe it's still day. Maybe it's still day. So, Rav Yehuda might be one answer. But another answer would be that we say that since the davening of Maariv is only, at most, a drabanan, and maybe even just a minhag, so I'm allowed to give myself the benefit of the doubt and treat it like night. But that only works on a rabbinic law, because rabbinic laws, you could be lenient. On a rabbinic law, you're given permission to assume leniency. But on a Torah law, you have to be strict. And since the recitation of Shema at night is a Torah law, the Kriya Shema that you read, Bein Hashmashos, you know, you're not going to be Yotzei. And that is why anybody who davens Maariv after Shkia, before Seis HaKochavim, will have to recite. You don't have to daven Shmon Esrei again, because Bein Hashmashos will cover you for Maariv. But you have to say Kriya Shema again, because Kriya Shema is Da'oraisa, and on that we say Safek Da'oraisa L'chumra. Now, in fact, it's interesting. The Rishonim had a little bit of a quandary here, because on one hand, you're telling me you're Yotzei Arvit, but you're not Yotzei Shema. Now, Shema is preceded by brachos before and brachos after. And it's optimal to say the Shema with the brachos. So how does that work if the Shema that you said, Bein Hashmashos, is not really your Shema, and you're saying the Shema afterwards? So there actually were Rishonim that said, if you're davening Arvit before Seis HaKochavim, you only do the Amida, and the Brachos and the Shema are said afterwards. But that's not the way we follow it. We say that you do say the Brachos early, because they too are Drabanan, and the Shema that you say later will be without the Brachos. And the reason is because we want to connect Go'al Yisrael to the Amida, just as we do in the morning. So in order to be Somech, Go'ula L'Tfilah, you have to say the brachas before. Okay. So now, let's go back to this American minion. Actually, I mean, some minyanim do it here as well. I mean, Sephardim actually may do it very often. They daven Maariv early. So you got this problem. It's the Omer period. So the question is, if we're davening Maariv early, are we allowed to count the Omer Bein Hashmashot? which is a Suffolk Yom, Suffolk Lila. So let's see. According to Tosos in Menachos, that the mitzvah of counting the Omer is only midrabanan. When it comes to a mitzvah to Rabbanan, we are allowed to be lenient. I could count Bein Hashmashos with a bracha. Safek to Rabbanan Lekula. According to the Rambam, that Sviras HaOmer is the Oraisa. Then it's like Shabbos. I can't give myself the benefit of the doubt. I wouldn't be allowed to count the Omer until it's Vadai, says HaKochavim. So even if I daven Arvis early, I would have to defer the counting of the Omer at night. Now, obviously, if you've ever been in an American shul, you know that if they daven Arv before Tzeis HaKochavim, they'll count the Omer, or at least the Chazan will count the Omer with the bracha before Tzeis HaKochavim. The short answer is that Rov Poskim do Paskin, like Tosfos and Menachos, that the counting is Midrabanan. But still, it is meritorious for you as an individual, Ms. Palel, to either defer your counting Lagamri, or if you want to count with a bracha early, recount, like Kriyashma, recount without a bracha, once Tzeis HaKochavim comes. Now, if a man is a chazan in such a shul, he certainly should follow the minhag of the shul, but even then, when he gets home, he should count at night, Tzeis HaKochavim, without a bracha. Now, there's an interesting little conundrum, a little bit of a brain teaser. On one hand, when a mitzvah is d'oraisa and you're in doubt whether you fulfilled it, you got to be strict. When a mitzvah is midrabanan and you're in doubt whether you fulfilled it, you're allowed to be lenient. What if there is a machlokas if a mitzvah is rabbanan d'oraisa? In other words, do I have to be machmir because maybe it's d'oraisa? In other words, this is exactly the situation here. Meaning, if there's a machlokas if it's d'oraisa or d'rabanan, which law applies to me, Safek Drabbanan Lekula or Safek Drabbanan Lechumra, right? That's going to be an issue. That's why some people will not count early, even though it's a machlokas, because they'll say that itself will be folded into the question of Safek Daraisa Lechumra, that I have to be machmer. Now, this has interesting, you know, outside of Omer, let me give you an interesting situation where this plays out by a bris. We know that if a baby is born on Shabbos, so the halacha is, assuming he's not a cesarean or something, the bris is done on Shabbos, right? Even though a bris milah is malacha, you're causing bleeding and everything else, but the bris milah is so important that it even overrides Shabbos. Now, of course, this only applies to the actual bris. This does not apply to the preliminaries. A moel cannot drive to a bris on Shabbos, etc. That's called machshire mila. Preparations for the mila do not override Shabbos, but the actual bris mila overrides Shabbos. Now, what if a baby is born in the Bein Hashmashos period, Friday afternoon, between sunset and Tzeis HaKochavim? Now, that means the baby is either a Friday baby, in which case the bris would be Friday, or the baby is a Shabbos baby, in which case the bris would be Shabbos. Now, if he's a Friday baby, I couldn't do the bris on Shabbos, because that would make Shabbos the ninth day after birth, and only a milah on the eighth day is Docha Shabbos. So, I have a quandary here. I can't circumcise the kid on Friday, because maybe he's a Shabbos baby, and Friday is day seven. Too early, a bris before 8 days is not kosher. But I can't circumcise him on Shabbos because maybe he's a Friday baby and Shabbos is day nine. So, in such a case, you got to do the bris on Sunday. Now, Sunday for sure is not the right day. Because if he's a Friday baby, right, so Sunday is day 10. And if he's a Shabbos baby, Sunday is day nine. You are simply missing the mitzvah of bris on the eighth day. But because of the Safek Bein Hashmashos, you have to push it up because you can't do the bris early and you can't do a late bris on Shabbos. You've got to do the bris on Sunday. Which is, again, it's very striking because Sunday for sure is the one day that's the wrong day. But that's the earliest day you're able to do the bris. Now, Lemaisa, That's why it is extremely important to try to have exact definitions of Bein HaShemashah. Yeah, I'm going to stop in a minute. In other words, Bein HaShemashah is between sunset and the stars coming out, but what exactly is the Pesach? Because I have to know. I have a baby during this twilight period. When can I do the Bris on Shabbos? So Lamaisa, because Eretz Yisrael is closer to the equator, so it actually gets dark much quicker. Twilight shortens. It's not based on winter and summer. It's not like long days, short days. It is based on proximity to the equator. So, for example, at the equator itself, there basically is no twilight. You know, as soon as the sun goes down, it's dark. As you get further north or further south, there is a longer period. So that's why New York, we would say, approximately is generally 42 minutes, or it's an approximation, basically, but of when it gets dark. But in Eretz Yisrael, although we will keep Shabbos longer for Tosefet Shabbos, but actually around 20 or 22 minutes. Again, God forbid, we don't end Shabbos that early because of Chumras. But Rav Yashiv, I believe, paskins that if the baby was born more than 22 minutes after sunset, you can treat that as Seis HaKochavim to allow a Shabbos bris. So it's confusing because the minutes we use are not consistent. For example, nobody in the world is ever going to tell you you can end Shabbos after 22 minutes. And yet, maybe I shouldn't say it, and yet, technically you could, but whatever, for Shabbos we want to be machmer, and there's a mitzvah tosefet Shabbos, so we always make it much longer, 35 minutes, 40 minutes, 42 minutes, etc. But here, you can't really afford to be too strict, because after all, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa of Brit Milah. So here, Rebbe Yosef said, 22 minutes already, you can paskin that it's night, and you can do a bris that is Docha Shabbos. And that's because in Eretz Yisrael, the twilight period is very, very short. I'm sure you've noticed this. You think you have plenty of time to daven mincha, and all of a sudden it's dark. Because that's the nature of it. So Bein HaShemashot, and people don't realize this, is not affected that much by length of the day. Meaning winter, summer is kind of the same, but it is affected by north and south of the equator. Okay, we'll stop here again. I apologize for being late, but we'll continue next week.